Blog Talk Radio.
Anyway, that was the music, everybody. Welcome to the Kate Thompson Live Show. I am the son. I'm trying to get all these electronics and all this stuff straight, man, and sometimes just drive you crazy. But this is the Kate Thompson Live Show. As I said, I am the son, otherwise known as Eric Payne, and I am about to introduce, trying to do some new configuration today. You are today, lady.
Kate Thompson Payne, how are you?
Go on, don't touch nothing. She's trying to touch stuff, folks. She knows she's not the person to be touching stuff. Go ahead, keep talking.
And, you know, we have, you know, really kind of, you know, another exciting show, Eric, today. You know, and I am very proud of this person that is going to be on the show today, and that's Dr. Len Jeffries. And he is a well-known international person with the movement. Years ago, and he was a, he 60 years, you know, involved in, you know, Black Power movement and, you know, the status of, you know, Black people in the United States and about Black Power movement. And, you know, he was a professor at and head of the Africana Studies at City College in New York, and we would have him on the show quite frequently in New York and WIBDLS, and the information that we were able to get from Dr. Jeffries was absolutely wonderful because we needed that information at that time, and as a matter of fact, we still need it. And so he will be calling in very shortly, and I'm going to, we're also going to be calling, you know, hearing from Wayne Gilman, you know, very shortly also. And we're going to be dealing with the you know, the present status, you know, of African Americans, you know, in this country, especially, you know, maybe we can address this for a minute or so while they're calling him, but especially, you know, I'm really fearful of the fact that, you know, Donald Trump is going to be leading this country, especially because of the things that he said in the past. I've said before that he was dangerously, you know, just a danger. You know, to the country. And here he is, he has made the presidency. We've heard of, you know, several things where people are, you know, protesting this, and I think they're calling for a recount. Is that so?
No, they're not calling. They're calling for a recount, yeah, you're right. Anyway, they're calling for a recount, but it's not going to change the election or anything like that. And I think we have here our other co-host calling in now, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Is that you, Mr. Gilman?
Good evening, Dr. Payne. How you doing? Citizen Payne, how you doing? And co-host with the mostest, Ms. Kay. How are you both?
How are you, Wayne?
I'm okay. I'm trying to live in the Trump world.
Uh-oh. Yeah, I wonder what it's going to be like.
I don't know. I'm scared.
Yeah. A lot of people,
there's
never been a situation like this. I mean, you know, we have a president who in the early mornings he tweets in the morning, and you know he's tweeting. I don't even know.
Well. God bless him. At that age, he could at least do that. You know, some men at that point have a hard time. But I don't mean to confuse you. My problem, I mean, I have to give him, and I don't want to misspeak too early because that whole deal with Carrier and the jobs that he saved in the Midwest, you know, I'm grateful for anybody who could pull that off. But I have to stop and take into consideration, you know, if that had been Barack Obama who had done that, what price would the Republican Party whiplash would have been if he was able to step in and intervene like that? And And that's the thing that I find so highly questionable, you know. Somehow big business is responding to Trump. And I guess maybe it's too early to give a definitive analysis to what occurred there. But I'm happy that the jobs of these 1,500 or 1,000 employees that would have been out of work, you know, that they'll be saved. But there's so many other people in the same boat. And I just can't help but feel that's part of the political grandstanding to make Obama look like his legacy is meaningless. We wasted 8 years there. And the Republicans are not going to take any kind of ownership for what they've done to cease the progress that the Democrats were trying to build upon after the debacle the Bushes left this country in. So, you know, nobody wants to go back that far. It just seems like all the problems started with Barack, and I have a problem with that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I still have a problem with his, you know, the vitriol, the demeanor, the depths of his nasty campaign against Hillary Clinton. I wanted there's a show tomorrow, I think, on The View. They're going to have the CNN, the black political analyst. I think his name, I want to say Van McCoy, but it's Van somebody.
Van Jones.
Van Jones, yeah, Van McCoy.
Right.
That's back in my disco past. I'm sorry.
Right.
The Van's no longer with us, but the deal is that Van Jones, he has a lot to say about where the Democrats went wrong. So I'm looking forward to hearing what he has to say. I did catch him the first night saying, you know, he said it was a white vote. You know, this was. It's not like as if anything had gone wrong. And then we have the issue with the whole count thing that you and Kay were just talking about a moment ago, Eric, the fact that they're looking for a recount. And of course, you know, something's got to be done. I really feel that at this point, the Electoral College should not even exist, you know. I mean, it's not like we're in the Stone Age where there's a lack of communication. And the fact that she won 2 million votes in the over Trump, and it's just now left to the wisdom of this little elitist body that was originally designed basically to stop people like Trump from being elected, because it's a personality thing, from what I understand. Somebody was saying a couple of weeks ago that was the reason why they formed the college. That was part of the reason why they formed the college. And, of course, to take care of those states where, you know, they wouldn't have much of a say compared to some other states, just to have it balanced. But I know that our mayor here in New York is about to launch a campaign to have it dismantled, and so that there will never be another election like that again. And I'm beginning to think that's the way it should go. You know, whoever won the most votes should be elected. That's it. The other thing about being in Trump world, all of his cabinet picks, I just I can't think of one that I'm really impressed with, you know, and I'm just waiting to see what comes out of this Mitt Romney. All of a sudden, he's his best friend. And it's like, I don't understand what's going on there. I really don't understand
right.
it.
Yeah, it's an interesting couple of points that you made, Wayne. First off, it's, you know, the whole thing about meeting with Romney, who was, this is why people don't like politicians, because Romney talked so bad about him before, and now he's there with him. Or he could be there, you know, kind of making stuff doesn't go bad. I've heard it talked about on some of the shows earlier today, that Trump said he was going to run the office, got elected on saying he was going to drain the swamp. And I think it was the congressman or senator out of Ohio, Sherrod Brown, said he he didn't drain the swamp. He put he filled the swamp with alligators. So
exactly.
You know, there's no reason to think that he is going to be any different. It's just how he was able to get over on people and things like that. But I'm going to ask our other caller to get involved in the conversation. We have another caller coming through. I think that is Dr. Jeffries.
Yes, it is.
Doctor,
yes, I'm on.
Hey, Dr. Jeffries, how you doing?
I'm fine. It's difficult times, but I'm hanging in there.
Yeah, Dr. Len Jeffries, always an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show.
That's right.
That's greatly. And what are you from? What's your from a historical perspective? You've been a historian, and you know, I always say I believe that knowing the history is to know the truth, right? So, is your perspective on this? Election?
Well, somebody or the ancestors or the creator told me when I saw the election was going in the wrong direction to cut my TV off for 4 days. And that was the best thing I ever did. And so all of that whatever analysis and all of that misanalysis and all of the reactions, I just didn't absorb. And then I got ready for these big activities that were on my calendar. And one was to go to Atlanta to receive the first annual Black Power Awards event, and that was great. And then the next was to get prepared for this past week where we had the State of the Black World 4th event, and it allowed us to come together and deal with what had happened in the elections. In fact, it was set up every 4 years, and it's been done for the last 4 elections. They have, after the election, gotten Black people together so we can discuss what has happened, what is happening, and what can we make happen in the future. So it was fantastic to be able to have all these people from all around the world come to Newark, New Jersey, my hometown, and other people have been involved in Newark and Greater Newark, such as the Thompson family and all the rest. And it was great to be at 50th anniversary of the Black Power Conference, which was in Newark just after the Urban Rebellion that took place in 67. And so this gave us a chance to have what I call a systems analysis. That we can react to what is happening. We can think we're having clear thinking. But if we don't have a systems analysis to put various elements together and look deep at what is happening, we get a superficial analysis. Trump is a manifestation of what this nation has been. The organization around power for rich white men and who had the property and who had their hands on the economics. So Trump is just the latest version of Washington, Jefferson, and Monroe that set up this nation for rich white men with property and power. And then after we struggled and helped keep the nation one in the Civil War, it looked like we were going to get some benefits out of it, but it just didn't occur. They put us into semi-slavery, wage slavery, after the Civil War. So here you got a new manifestation of Jefferson and Washington, and that was the white folks who had been in slavers who got control of the Supreme Court. They tried to negate the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. We didn't get the vote. We had to wait another 100 years of struggle to get the vote. And then again, we have World War One. Again, they don't want us involved, but they need us. So we fight in World War One, and then after the war, instead of us getting the votes and the what we need and some support, they give us, I call it the road not taken. So Trump is just the latest version of all of that. And so we have to understand that the country was designed for rich white men with property and power. The Electoral College is a perfect example. Most people say, well, does popular vote count? It does, but it doesn't count in terms of real power. The Electoral College was put in place to give the small states and the slave states a weighted vote in the power equation of America's rich white men. So, you know, we need to look deep. After the Civil War, instead of us getting the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment rights, the corporate person was created in 1867. John D. Rockefeller, Standard Oil, the year after my grandfather was born, 1868, and he was supposed to get 13th Amendment, 14th Amendment, 15th Amendment, but he never got them. But the Supreme Court interpreted our rights and created the corporate person and gave Standard Oil and J.P. Morgan and Jay Gould and Harriman, all those rich white folks, got our votes, and they became so powerful they controlled the nation. By 1900, you had the trust busters, Teddy Roosevelt trying to bust the trust, because you had the robber barons, and they gave them that nice name, robber barons. They were controlling the company, country, buying whole state governments, senators, et cetera, and all kinds of graft. So, you know, the ideal of America is one, the reality of America is another, and systems analysis would let us have the reality of America as first and foremost, instead of the ideals of freedom, justice, and equality. I try to make the equation very simple, that the nation was founded on all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among these life, liberty, and the pursuit of Negroes. I mean, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But, you know, that was a slip that was on purpose, because the happiness was the pursuit, the ownership of Negroes, the dehumanization of Negroes. It was these Negroes that built this nation, that no plantation owner had anything to do with, except for planning, that he wanted a plantation and hundreds of acres of land and hundreds of Africans to work it. But the Africans were the wheelwrights, the carpenters, the blacksmiths. They were the nurses. They were the cooks. They were the architects. We have to understand our role, and we weren't given our human dignity. So that's America. You know, I wish our president, he's a good man, and his wife is certainly beautiful and talented. He got the two angels running around the White House. They got a couple of dogs there, black and white dogs, and they got the mother-in-law there. So they blackened up the White House, but they haven't blackened up the power equation.
Yeah.
So
got to go deep. We got to go deep with this, and don't get depressed. I remember when the attacks came on me, and luckily I grew up in Newark, New Jersey, Greater Newark, East Orange, Montclair, and all the rest of that. And so I was prepared to deal with other peoples, other ethnic groups. That was a part of the mix. And so when they came at me in the 90s, when we had the culture wars and we're fighting for putting the truth of the history, the whole world history, in the curriculum, they said that we need to go for the point guy who is the point man of this movement, and they came at me, and I was the best person they could come to, because there was no way, with the background I had and the experience I had, I was going to step aside, bow down, ask forgiveness. I made a mistake by saying and implying and laying out the documentation that African peoples are the first peoples on the planet. African peoples, everybody else comes out of the African gene pool. African peoples laid the foundation for humanity, living like humanity and taking it to its highest level in terms of high culture and civilization, mathematics, philosophy, and science. All of that is ours. And I wasn't going to apologize for that, but they came at me, and I just mobilized communities around the world that I went to 300 universities in 3 years or 3.5 years. Same truth was spoken. I introduced myself in the same way. Don't get mad. Don't get sad. Get prepared. Stop worrying about the books and get in. Stop worrying about the looks and get into the books.
Right.
Forget about the behind and get into your African mind. Now, once I went to Harvard and Yale and Oxford and Rio de Janeiro and Brasilia and Europe, with that, it woke people up. They said, well, who is this guy? This professor, they say he's the worst person in the world, and here he is trying to get us all revved up to look at things seriously. And after I did that and kind of captured them, then I said, we got to get serious, and we have to pay respects to the ancestors and the creator that allowed the ancestors lay the foundations of culture and civilization for us, and so we have to pay homage. And so could you please stand so we can have a moment of respect in what is called the libation? Well, the black youngsters were up on their feet. Brown youngsters were up on their feet. White folks didn't know whether to get up or just sit down. In many cases, they just sat down. And then I did a libation acknowledging thanking the Creator for allowing our ancestors to lay the foundation for civilization and culture. And once I separated out the wheat from the chaff, I was able to boom, 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 boom with the books, with the information, etc. So, hey, that's what I want to arm you guys with. So you don't, you know what a Trump is. A Trump is just the latest version of what the Rockefellers were, what the Jeffersons and Monroes were, that people have put this system together for themselves and then covered it with the American flag. That flag is dripping in blood. You know, and here we are. And so the football player out there in San Francisco, he tapped into the right thing. He has a right. America is based upon freedom of speech. And so he's expressing himself. And people say, well, he's trying to, you know, he's got his own design. Everybody has their designs. We don't know what's in his mind. And coming from the background he has, he's got major dilemmas that he's been dealing with. So now he wants to express them. So, hey.
Right.
Tap into the knowledge, and you got a chance. Tap away from it, and you're suffering what Dr. Wade Nobles, my buddy from the West Coast, said so clearly. African people, black people everywhere suffer greatly from a shattered consciousness and a fractured identity. But I'll tell you one thing. The Trump phenomena has waken us up. I mean, people who were not awake before, they better look at things now. And don't be crying and be moaning. Just agonize, no. Organize, yes. And then understand the strengths and your power. And the best thing that we got going is ourselves. You know.
Right.
And we have to understand that. But, and we got caught up in the wrong concept. Yes, we needed to integrate. And King led that integration period of the 50s and 60s. But we missed out on the first level of integration should be ourselves. And then you can integrate with the larger society. We flipped the script. In other words, we wanted to integrate, for example, on the bus boycott, 55. Our sister and everybody pays homage to her. And the people walked for 381 days supporting our sister and the movement. The community was mobilized and galvanized. They put carpools together. And they bought the bus company down. So instead of us pulling our monies together and buying the bus company, we go for an integration so we can sit with white folks when we should have had a concept of economic power that we are the people holding this thing up, and let's use our power to serve us. And so I think that's a lesson for us to learn, you know. So I'm a professor. You can get me going forever. You just have to stop me and ask me questions.
Yeah,
Professor Jeffries, I just wanted to, first of all, this is Wayne Gilman. How you doing? And it's good to hear your voice. Always good, great to hear from you. I was just curious. There's a movement afoot now. The mayor of New York, de Blasio, is trying to start a campaign to end the Electoral College. What is your thought on that? In a way, I guess you sort of answered the question in terms of, you know, its evolution, but, I mean, do you think that matters?
What it does is it creates a paralysis of analysis. Hey, you know, when I had to go around the world speaking at 300 universities and places, I had to come up with something. A paralysis of analysis. We're going to focus on the Electoral College when the whole system is designed to maintain rich men with property and power. The Supreme Court is designed for that purpose. We put in place a system of checks and balances, but that was to make sure one particular division, the legislative division or the governmental division or the Supreme Court division, didn't dominate. But it was the only game in town was for rich white men with property and power. The nation was born with the vote for rich white men with property. Ordinary white people didn't have the vote in America. Most white people in America didn't have the vote. That was the women. So we need to look at the whole system and not just a piece of it. You get a paralysis of analysis if you think you can straighten out the system by dealing with the Electoral College. But the whole thing was designed to gain and maintain rich white men with property and power. I said in the beginning of the nation, they set it up for property owners. The three-fifths clause. I keep telling Jesse, stop talking about that damn three-fifths clause like we had three-fifths rights. We had no rights in the American founding. The three-fifths clause gave three-fifths more power to the slave-owning voters in America. People have to understand that. That if a slave owner had 200 Africans on his plantation, he had his vote, and then he had three-fifths of the 200 Africans. That gave a weighted vote to this nation, to the slave owners. So it's not just the electoral college. They set it up with various, they set aside. You know, they talk about a set aside. We don't want to give people no set aside. The nation was founded on a set aside. They had the Declaration of Independence, 1776. They tried a loose confederation. It didn't work, so then they wanted to tighten it up. So they had a Constitutional Congress in 1787, and they produced the Constitution of the United States. Now that's 1787. There was a movement to end slavery. And our so-called founding fathers said, wait a minute, we just can't end it like that. That's our money. So let's set aside 20 years before we end the slave trade, not even the slavery itself. And so in the Constitution is a reference to ending the enslaved trade, but a 20-year set-aside for these rich white men to make adjustments, and Jefferson and Washington did. What the adjustment was they created an internal slave trade. Since the external, the overseas slave trade was going to be stopped, even the English led the movement to stop it. And so Jefferson and Washington, when they were in financial trouble, and they always were in financial trouble because they're living above their means, they could sell a lot of 10 Africans on their plantations to the cotton kingdom moving to the west, moving out to Alabama, the western part of Georgia, on into Arkansas, et cetera, Alabama. And so they were able to keep afloat by selling lots of 20 or more Africans. And then we're just finding out that even America's institutions, Harvard, Yale, all of them, Georgetown, the Jesuit institutions, did the same thing. To found these great universities in America, they had Africans enslaved, and to get money, Georgetown, to save it as an institution, sold 292 Africans from the Washington area down into Mississippi and Alabama, and that saved Georgetown as an institution. Hey, we got to get into this history, brother. So that little electoral college is just a reference to the whole system set up for rich white men with property and power.
Well, Dr. Jeffries, I want to know what you suggest. You've had over 60 years in the movement. Am I correct?
Organize, don't agonize, and forget about trying to be white. Be brown and black, Africanize. And then in your brown and blackness, you can relate to anybody. But if you think the only thing that's going to get you anywhere is to try to be like white folks, be with white folks, love white folks, swear by white folks, on your knees praying to white folks, you're going to still be in trouble.
I'm not
a racist. Some of my best friends are white, and practically most of my fraternity brothers when I went to college were Jewish. So I'm thoroughly integrated into the American system. I got my degrees from the best schools in America. Columbia University, first person to get a master's in African studies and a PhD from Columbia University. Even had nerve enough before I went to Columbia to go to law school for a year, NYU Law School. Got out of that because I wanted to deal with Africa. And I wanted to deal with Africa because I spent a year and a half in Europe before I went to NYU when I graduated from Lafayette College, and I went to Europe to study international affairs. I didn't want to study in Paris. It's too big. There's too much going on. I didn't want to study in Brussels. I didn't even want to study in Geneva. I picked the smallest little place I could find a university, and that was Lausanne on Lake Geneva, an old castle and an abandoned cathedral. That's where the university was, and that's where I studied international affairs in French in Europe. I call that my million, all of that, including Barringer High School. I call that my million-dollar white boy education. But to allow me to be with other blacks that are turning history upside right and following Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark and Dr. Chancellor Williams and all those who led the way, by putting the truth in the history of the world, that doesn't come from the white education, because the white education was worshiping the system of white supremacy, white values, white culture. It comes from Africanizing. And that started in the beginning with my mother in my house in Newark, New Jersey, on 14th Street, and the whole community I grew up with. It was like an African village. Of the 100 youngsters I grew up with, 90 of us made it, because we were you're going to be somebody, and no matter how poor you are, you're not poor. You're rich. You can be somebody. And so I'm saying it's the multi-billion-dollar African education that allows me to even speak as I'm speaking now without any hesitation, and allows me to have defended myself against the biggest attack in the history of the world against a professor.
Professor Jeffries, I know you and the former mayor of New York, Rudolph Giuliani, have had a history in terms of, you know, fighting the issues of the day going back 20 years now. When you see how he has put himself, you know, in this situation where he's now under consideration for a cabinet post, I would dread to think that he'd be the next U.S. Attorney General. You know, they're also taking into consideration that he may become Secretary of State, which would put him on the world stage even more than what he's been on, you know, since 9/11. We could protest, and I know this man, you know, from the time that you were at City College, had been a thorn at your side. How do you combat his rise to power now?
Well, it's the same as previously. You have to analyze what is happening, and then you have to make your plans on what you're going to do, and then you have to have put in place a blueprint for what you're going to do so you have the capability of doing it. So now that the system is going to reward black folk for saving it, Barack Obama was brought in as president to save the system. He wasn't brought in to take care of folk. And he provided an international persona that gave people a feeling around the world that America was going to make it through this crisis. And he went everywhere, the Middle East. He went to Europe. He went to Berlin, the seat of the Nazi insanity. And there was 250,000 people there to hear his words. Now, you think if Trump went to Berlin, there's going to be 200,000. If Giuliani went to Berlin, there's going to be if Christie went to Berlin, there's going to be 250,000 looking for a vision or an understanding of how we can get to this crisis. So there's nothing we can do about the Giuliani. He'll be there forever. He's like cockroaches. He's not going to disappear, and he's going to find a way of hustling, and so we just have to be ready for this period of time and strengthen ourselves. I had wanted, at the big conference in Newark, I helped to open it up after Danny Glover made a very strong opening statement, and then our sister Barbara King, who worked close with the leadership in Newark, she made a strong statement. She's head of the connection to Africa for the city of Newark and the Newark, greater Newark community. And then I spoke, representing the international perspective and someone who grew a son of Newark and greater Newark. Well, anyway, one of the things I said, what we should do is have a plan. And then that plan includes not buying in the insanity that we have been caught up in since we've been here, and since we've got a semi-freedom. They said, you can buy anything you want, and we'll give you as much credit as you want. And they've been doing that ever since they gave us so-called freedom. I was saying Black Friday is symbolically the time when profit is made in America's economics. And so we are the margin of profit. We spend more than anybody else and at a greater percentage than anybody else on things. So I was saying, let's make it a real Black Friday. Since we're going to be faced with the Trumps and the Giulianis and the Christies and all these other folks that's coming at us and going to put the blame for every problem in America on us, let's save our money. Let's make it a real Black Friday, and let's announce to our people to save the money. Put it away. Hide it under mattresses, or put it in black institutions, or create your own institutions where you control your money. Just the thought of that, just if 1,000 of us coming from all over the world and all over America had made that statement, and actually it was one of the resolutions that Dr. Ronald Daniels was going to read, but he actually left some of his notes, so he had to do what he had to do from his own head. He did a fantastic job. But that was one of the items, that we should look at the issue of holding our money, because hard times are going to be coming in. We're going to be punished for standing up for our rights and standing
right.
up for the Democratic Party, that was the institution that we could work with, knowing that there was no play in the Republican Party. But it didn't get done. Can you imagine? My suggestion was that we save our money on Black Friday and then keep saving it after Black Friday and go past the Santa Claus and his reindeers and save our money, spend a little bit of it during the Kwanzaa period, and go past New Year's and save it, and go up through King's birthday, go up to January the 25th, holding on to your money, because times are going to be hard for us. Do you know what a message would have sent to the whole system and structure?
Sure.
No question.
Dr. Jeffries, if
so that's the type of thing.
Like,
economics is the key in any development. Life is centered around economics. Economics is your creative, productive capability. Everything living has to be creative or productive, otherwise it dies. Even the universe and the multiverse have to be creative and productive economically. And then you have to have politics in the picture, because politics manages your economics. But then you have to have culture, and that's the deep thought. That's the values. Culture tells you what type of economics to have and who to do your politics with. And so we've got to have that type of system in the African-American and the African-Latino community for us to deal with the Giulianis and the Trumps of the world.
So if I could just point out, it seems that because I was going to ask the very question of how do we, and it almost seems like there needs to be an organized effort to have a, because these individuals that are on the other, that are the dominant culture, seem to have put a plan in place, a 20, 30, 40 century year plan of the next 100 years, how they have just a system that we live under that you talk about is a system designed for wealthy white men with property to retain and forever continue to grow that wealth. And so it leaves us in a position to understand the system that we live under and its historical references, but then to formulate some sort of plan of action over the next 20, 30 years, which seems to have been, to me, more prevalent or obvious from the previous generation, your generation, my parents' generation, and before that, where it seemed that black people were more united in terms of moving as a collective group. And it almost seems like, Dr. Jeffries, a lot of us aren't paying attention to the history, because if we talk about the recent news today, the recent appointment of the Treasury Secretary, you know, it's the example of wealthy white men with property, you know.
Right, and one who was in the middle of the crash and who profited from it didn't serve a day in jail with all of that went on. So that's why I'm saying if the mayor of New York was to just deal with the Electoral College, that's an enormous mistake. We need to deal with the whole system. American wealth has been taken out of America. Trump and the others talked about industries going from America. The money went from America. Trillions of dollars are in offshore, in Latin America, in the islands off of the Caribbean, in the Bahamas, in Bermuda. Trillions of dollars. Rich white folks were able to take it out of the nation. Waiting for what?
Right.
The period of great profiteering. They have it. So if we're going to talk about making some changes, let's look at the whole thing. That let's say, ideally, you're talking about freedom, justice, and equality, and all men are created equal, women, et cetera. Well, let's talk about not just cleaning up the swamp that's in Washington, but what somebody said recently is that he's putting alligators in the swamp. He ain't cleaning it up. And so we have to say, poor who lost their industries, et cetera, in the Rust Belt, and those farmers who have lost out to the big combines, et cetera, we have to say there has to be an assessment of who made profit out of the crises in America. And you'll see it's the same rich families and traditions and corporations. So I'm saying, yes, we need a plan. What most of our people have learned to survive I call it survival culture. But if we're going to sustain ourselves globally, we have to move to developmental culture. That means we as African mm-hmm. people have to control our economics. We don't have any control of it. We make money. We have more than $1 trillion of disposable income. That puts us among the most important states on the planet. That
right.
is the income, that is income and wealth equal to 29 American states.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to understand what power we have. But when we grew up in North New Jersey, we used to take our little nickels and dimes down to dime savings. We were trained and taught how to save, even though times are hard
right.
and rough. We're a depression. Your parents and myself and others, we're born in the depression. I remember those little coins, little red tokens we had when you went to go get some food. But we never let that define us. We stayed the course. And when things broke after World War II and there was opportunities, they were giving them first to white folks, but then we waited and were ready to move on to make our gains. And then in the 50s into the 60s, we was making some heavy gains. The system said, wait a minute. We have to find a method to destroy black folks moving collectively, controlling cities and dealing with states and linking up with the Caribbean and South America and Africa. So they actually put in place a plan to disrupt us. And the purpose and the main purpose was to disrupt the education, disrupt the psychology, create this individualism and this consumerism, where we have our children going into the supermarket, telling us what they want, going into the drugstores, pointing to children. We would never. That's not what we could do. We knew that we had our parents and our grandparents were taking care of us. We didn't go in there. I want this. I want that. So they have actually created a culture of anti-humanness and materialism. There's a culture that things make you. They've dumped drugs in our community. In the 70s and 80s, the response to the explosion of the 60s and black independent movements around the world and in the Caribbean and new nations being formed and new organizations and blacks organizing, the black social workers, the black psychiatrists, the black doctors, the black lawyers, the black professors. In response to all of that was a war on drugs, which was a code for a war on black folks.
Mm.
Yeah.
In response to government policies, which were designed to give you a stake, but it was designed to make you dependent. So when we met this past week in Newark, we said we need to have models of how we deal with our economics, how we deal with the policy, how we deal with education, how we deal with culture, et cetera. And then they said, let's make Newark, New Jersey a model city of how you deal as African peoples with your communities. That was a mind-blowing thing. We got a model cities program, but it was a political tie-in. We're going to give you some model cities, not to make your city a model city and to help poor people take control of their destiny. We're going to give you enough of a little crumb off the table so that you'll be part of the Democratic Party when we come around to vote. And they put enough in there for us to fight for over it, but not enough in there to make a difference. Now that we've seen the failure of that, now that we've seen what drugs can do, now that we've seen how we integrated, unfortunately, into America without really being integrated, taking 9 children in Little Rock and integrating them into the insanity of whiteness is not integration. Taking your little babies and integrating them into white schools and letting the rest of the school system deteriorate. We got caught up in the insanity of integration. That's not integration. Taking our children into the Boston schools, they just had my nephew, Dr. Hassan Jeffries, he was part of Henry Louis Skip the Truth Gates program most recently about what has happened in America, and it was well done. And Henry Louis Skip the Truth Gates, Dr. Henry Louis is a friend of mine, but he is Skip the Truth Gates. I don't care. He's Skip Gates, and I add Skip the Truth out of love and affection. When we meet, he greets and doing all kinds of handshakes with me, et cetera, et cetera. But Hassan, for example, my nephew, he did a study of Bloody Lounge, struggle for the vote in Lounge County. And so what we have to understand is that systematically we've been messed over economically. Systematically we've been messed over politically. Systematically we've been messed over culturally. You have the black doll test. Now, all of us heard about that, and certainly Thompson into beauty and into grace and dignity. I remember the studio. And our babies, you give them a choice of whether they want a Barbie doll with blonde hair or a doll that looks like them. The babies are picking the Barbie doll.
Mm-hmm.
So that means somebody else is controlling our socialization, how we get our values, our beliefs, our role models, and our patterns of behavior. And they're dealing negative with our culturalization. How do you fit into society? We want to be able to, we want to fit into society. We've been programmed to fit into society like white people instead of fitting into society as a proud black person and then letting people appreciate your proudness. So we have to look at the cultural damage done after Nixon and these others put in COINTELPRO to destroy the progressive, even revolutionary leadership. Everybody's proud of a revolution. We talk about the American Revolution. It wasn't no damn revolution. It was the rich Americans trying to rip the system off from the British and put in place themselves to control the slave system. That's not a revolution. That's musical chairs. The French Revolution went crazy. They started chopping off everybody's head. The only real revolution in that revolutionary period of substance was the Haitian Revolution. And because the Haitian Revolution was destroyed the plantation and the plantation owners, they have been published to this day, hundreds of years later. Haiti is still paying a price for being a real revolution. And here we're talking about revolutionary leaders sitting on other people's lands, the Native American lands, and putting in place a genocide of the Native Americans and then bringing over people who had nothing to do with them in an enslavement system that didn't last for a weekend or a couple of weeks or a couple of months, but hundreds of years. So this truth we've got to make a part of our culture. Not that we're going to be mad. As I said, be glad that this truth has emerged. It's the most fantastic thing to be in the middle of the explosion of this truth, that we don't have to sit back and say, I wish I was, or I wish I was like them. We are it in terms of the human family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you have to train your children. Our mothers and popes, when we went into the white classes, we didn't go in with no inferiority complex. We went in as a 10-year-old in Newark, New Jersey. I was ready to do battle. Why? Because at 9 in 1946, somebody called Joe Lewis was beating up on white folks. Every month, there was a bum of the month, and you saw the brown bomber take him down. And he had taken down the Nazi image of greatness.
Right.
Just as Jesse Owens have from Jersey and the other brothers, they took down and showed the Nazis that your supposed inferiority had not run up into black power yet. And so that was part of us growing up. We didn't have a sense of inferiority. When we were in those classes with white kids, we knew we were on a par with them or even better. I was the president of the grammar school with 40 of us. In the class with five or six blacks. And I was the president. It was no rare thing. Nobody was going to raise flags. Jeffrey was the president. I've been the leader of everything that I've done. We were trained to be leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to say that we really have to change the culture, the economics, and the politics to serve our interests and to relate it to the larger interests of the American nation. But if we don't have our declaration I don't know what we're going to call it, since they want to now punish us for standing up for our rights, and since they want to destroy everything that Obama has tried to do, when they met the very night that he was being installed as the president, and they said, we're going to block everything that he tries to do.
Yeah.
And we can't go in with our eyes open thinking it's easy. No, this is struggle. And we learned to struggle. 46, Joe Lewis was doing his thing. 47, well, we were following Jackie Robinson in 46. We went up to Montreal to see Jackie Robinson. And then when he busted into the major leagues, we busted in there with him. We were ready to take on the world. And then in 48, 49, you got Paul Robeson. And then Jackie, they took the control over Jackie. They took the control off of him. So 1949, he went crazy. He was the most valuable player. He was running up down the Bates Pass, scaring the people to death. That's when I became the president of my grammar school, because I was thinking,
inspired,
I was
learning by that.
You see, so that's what I'm saying, the socialization, how you get your beliefs, your role models, your patterns of behavior. And that's when the Thompsons and the Jeffries and the Curvins and the Paynes and the others were being trained. We were teenagers being trained by Madeline Williams, Orange Maplewood NAACP. And in Newark, you had Grace Baxter Fenderson. This woman took us under her wing to give us training and how we can be somebody, and how we had to struggle if we wanted to get something. So,
Professor Jeffries, I hate to interrupt. I just have one last question.
No, you
I'm
don't.
Sorry,
I can hear you now. You're so glad to cut me off. And so,
No. In all honesty, we're not a monolith, and we are so fragmented. We have the NAACP, we have Black Lives Matter, we have Urban League, we have this, that, the other. How do we get on the same page? I think
There's 50 million of us. Yesterday was my 52nd wedding anniversary, and my wife and I have been together for 54 years as a result of Africa. She went to Africa in 1960, to Nigeria. I went on that same program in 61, and then we met. And then in 64, we got married. But we were dealing with each other ever since in terms of Africa. So I'm saying that we have to understand that we're caught up in a white world, white dreams, and white processes. And we have to sit back and say, wait a minute, where does the black interest, I call it VIP, for the European, the VIP means very important person. For the African, VIP means values, interest, and principles and processes. And so that's what we have to make as the centerpiece of our world, and put a Africanite, organize, agitate, educate, organize, and Africanize. We done tried everything else. We done tried the leaching creams, and that ain't saved us. And now we got hair from Asia hanging down our back, and that ain't going to do it either. And, you know, we have the greatest athletes in the world, and they're making millions of dollars, but not controlling it. We have great artists and creative geniuses like Alex Haley, who produced the most
successful. But you know what we don't have? You know what we don't
have?
Say that
again?
I said, you know, we don't have the fire in the belly. Remember that?
Well,
the fire in the belly.
That's right. We were trained that you're going to struggle and you have to be ready to sacrifice. But I'm not saying we don't have it, because I think with this movement in Black Lives, it shows that there's something there. But then who is leading it? Who organized the Wall Street thing? There's a certain group of people who have led us, and we have to say, wait a minute. Let's make sure our people are in the lead, because a certain group of led us in the civil rights movement, and they were first and foremost concerned with their civil rights and using us to open up the doors for them. There were certain other people who led us in the labor movement, but then when things got hot, they separated the black labor movement. We had trouble getting into these unions. Even to this day, the Italian community had a lock on many unions.
Right.
And when I got my first job, which was on 4th Street in Newark, New Jersey, across from my house, it was a sweater factory. And the sweater factory was organized ethnically. It was owned by Arnie and his brother, Sachs. And they took care of the drawing of the patterns for the sweaters, et cetera. Now, the knitting machines, that was all ethnic. But what ethnic groups? The Italians and the Poles. The pressing was black folk. And the little Jewish guy, he couldn't relate to these Italians and those Poles. They didn't want him out there. He was pressing like us, sweating just like us on the pressing machine. All of us made money. America's economics has been organized ethnically. And we haven't been able to carve out a piece for ourselves. The teachers' union, the Jewish community got a big stake in the teaching industry. The police, the Irish got a big stake in that. And these jobs in the ports and the police, et cetera, and the ports like Newark, Port Newark, the mob has a big control over those things. They've legitimized themselves. I hate to go deep in this thing, but we may need to keep it superficial and then have our sessions with each other so we can go deep on these things. But we got to deal with the mind control, and that's the point that we're trying to make.
Exactly.
On our young people. But I'm saying, as I go around the world, I was in the Gambia for a conference on slavery, colonialism, reparations, Little Gambia. And it was so wonderful to see all those hundreds of young Gambian students, the women with their head tied because it's a largely Muslim nation, but there wasn't hiding, no hide. The women were right out front. They were helping to organize the thing. So we felt, my wife and I felt this African surge of coming from this little nation that shouldn't even be a nation with these youngsters who were in this conference, that international conference that we had like no other conference. And at the end of it, I said we need to not only thank France Fanon's daughter Muriel for participating and the Jeffries and the others from Nigeria and Ghana. We need to thank the students from Gambia, the young ladies who've been a part of this process in ways that I have never seen any young people. I've been conferencing for 65 years, started with the NAACP 13 and 14, and I have never seen a full participation of young people like I saw in the Gambia. Then they had this thing for the Black Power Awards that was organized in Atlanta. And I thought I would have to go down there. They had to deal with all that nasty MFs and all that mess coming from a segment of our young population. And my wife said, I'm going to Seattle to deal with the spiritual conference there. You're going to Atlanta to deal. This is what you're going to deal with, because we went on the internet and saw some of these people and whatnot. But when we got to Atlanta, I went down there ready to sacrifice my life, if necessary, to prevent chaos, because it was going to be in the Epic Center. The Epic Center was built by the Bronners. The Bronners is a part of our family, all coming from rural Georgia. But that session of 1,000 or more people, and we were there from 2 in the morning. We were there for 10 hours. There was no conflict. There was no. Everybody was beautifully dressed. The young fellows had head-to-toe African dress. The women were so dignified. It was unbelievable what they put together. And so I'm saying I have seen our young people with fire in the belly. And then when we had the conference most recently in Newark, you had literally hundreds, if not thousands of people coming from all over, and all of them in control. All of them wanted to make a major presentation, but they knew they had to let these voices from other people speak. So if the level of what I participated in the last few months is any criteria of what's happening, we need to look at it and make it work. It's more than just marching in the streets. It's actually planning how you're going to deal with the suites, and that's how we have to have it. We can't expect 50 people to be moving together. It's going to be a diverse. We are very complex. We're organized into all of these associations, women's groups, men's groups, fraternities, sororities, masons, et cetera. How do we take that movement and turn it toward doing for self and not trying
and
to
make...
Let's let that be a question for our next episode,
Dr. Jeffries, because we're just about out of time right about now. And we want to thank you once again for enlightening us and giving us a perspective about things of where we stand in the world today, and as a historical reference, and where we need to kind of need to chart forward. We want to thank Dr. Len Jeffries for being our guest again. As always, we love and respect you. Thanks for joining us in.
Thanks, Wayne Gilman. And also,
thank you, Kay and Eric. I appreciate Dr. Jeffries.
Yeah. And also,
and it's not about me. It's a family affair. And that's how I appreciate this show, because I see the generations working together, and that's what we have to be all about.
But Dr. Jeffries, and we have to do this again.
Yes, we will. Yes. All right.
All right.
Now.
Thank
Peace.
You, Dr. Jeffries.
Struggle continues.
All right. And Wayne Gilman, thanks once again. I disconnected you a little bit prematurely, wanted to give you your sign off, but I'm sure, as usual, you would say thank you, Kay and Eric, and we would say thank you, legend, and I would say thank you, legendary newsman Wayne Gilman. And once again, this has been the Kay Thompson Live Show on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can find us every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. on blogtalkradio.com/KayThompsonLive. You can listen to the show at any time you want, because it is archived. My name is Eric Payne, also known as the Sun, and you are
Kay Thompson. And I am the mother of Eric Payne. Everybody join us every Wednesday, 8 to 9. to all who listen. Thanks to all who are on the air. Boy, Dr. Lennon.
Thank you. Thank you for listening, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you.